From the City of Angels, near the Pacific Ocean, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation, around the world. I'm George Norrie. Welcome to Coast AM. Later on tonight, a psychic's view of the world, questions from Earth, answers from Heaven. Here's what's happening. Oh boy, it's getting tense. An armed Russian fighter jet buzzed a U.S. Air Force reconnaissance aircraft in the Baltic Sea. The Russian jet had air-to-air missiles under its wings and approached the U.S. Air Force recon jet rapidly, coming within 5 feet of the American aircraft. 5 feet. Once alongside, the jet was very provocative in its flight maneuvers and flying very erratically. Now, since June 2nd, there have been more than 35 interactions in the Baltic Sea region between U.S. and Russian jets and warships. An Iranian opposition group has found 12 sites not previously disclosed where the Islamic government is developing ballistic missiles with the help of who? North Korean experts. A growing number of U.S. lawmakers are declaring the death of the American college student Otto Warmbier just days after he was released from a North Korean prison, murder, and all eyes are now on the White House as the Trump administration weighs possible responses to that horrible situation. The U.S. Navy says the bodies of seven American sailors killed in a collision between their destroyer and a container ship off the Japanese coast have headed home. The USS Fitzgerald collided with a Philippine-flagged container ship in the early hours of Saturday, sustaining severe damage to its side and flooding some compartments with sailors trapped inside. Captain Kelly Sweeney, of course, our expert on the sea. Kelly, who's responsible for this situation?
Ahoy, George. Well, right now the Japanese maritime authorities, the U.S. Navy, and the U.S. Coast Guard are all conducting investigations and to answer that particular question. But from what I know so far, I've been able to draw three conclusions.
Okay, what are they?
The first one is that, and you know, this has correlation to shore. You know, just like there's rules of the road, you know, like you go up to a stop sign and you yield right of way. Well, we have nautical rules of the road out on the seas. And in a crossing situation, another vessel crossing the path.
Mm-hmm. There are rules, you're right.
That's right. The vessel that has the other on its starboard or right side has to keep out of the way of the other ship. So if this was a crossing situation, if the authorities determined, based on the black box review of things, that it was a crossing situation, the ACX Crystal T-bones the Fitzgerald on its right or starboard side, the Fitzgerald would be at fault.
But doesn't the Fitzgerald have the capability, Kelly, of knowing that a ship is coming its way and then, you know, doing whatever you have to do, maneuvers or otherwise, to get it to stop? If anything, shooting a missile at it, stopping it for a
while. Well, they wouldn't do that, but they both have people on the bridge supposedly doing monitoring everything. But however, George, that's only a crossing situation. If it was determined to be an overtaking situation and the ACX Crystal was overtaking the Fitzgerald and slammed in on its starboard side, the ACX Crystal has to keep out of the way. Just like if you're in a car lane on the highway and somebody comes up behind you, it's their job to keep out of your way. Okay, so based on what you said on your question, yes. There were people on the bridge of both those vessels whose responsibility it was to keep their ship safe and avoid this collision.
And they all must have seen what was happening.
There's no question in my mind. The officer of the deck on the Fitzgerald and the officer of the watch on the foreign flag ACX Crystal, in my opinion, both failed to uphold their personal, professional responsibilities. And why do I say that? Because, well, the collision happened in the first place. And are they watching each other come in before they hit? And neither one called the captain for assistance. I don't know any Navy captain or any Merchant Marine captain who doesn't write night orders before they go retire for the evening, that tells the junior officers on the bridge, hey, if we're getting in danger, call me.
Exactly. And tragically,
if you have confusion or doubt, call me. If there's other ships within a certain distance, a mile or two or 5,000 yards or whatever it is, call me. And neither captain on either ship was on the bridge at the time of that collision. They were completely unaware of the danger that their ships were in, and I blame that personally, directly on the officer of the deck on the Navy ship and the officer of the watch on that container.
Heads are going to roll on that one. Kelly, thank you so much. Captain Kelly Sweeney. The central train station in the Belgian capital of Brussels evacuated today after an explosion was reported and police shot a suspect wearing an explosive belt who shouted Allah Akbar in what officials described as a foiled terror attack. Yellowstone supervolcano, the caldera, has been hit by a series of earthquakes with more than 400 recorded since June 12th. That's amazing. 400 recorded swarms. Let's check in with Cal Ori. She's an expert, wrote the book, The Man Who Predicts Earthquakes, about our friend, the late Jim Berkland. Cal, something's happening at Yellowstone.
Yeah, well, there's two schools of thought. There's a university seismologist in Utah, and he's saying there's no cause for alarm. Chill, come on up, even enjoy a quake or two for your vacation. I'm not kidding. He wrote that today. He said that. But then there's other reputable scientists that are saying that there's 10% odds of a supervolcano happening there this century.
It's way overdue.
Yeah. It's happened 3 times in 2 million years. And they're saying it could rip the guts out of America. So I'm thinking, every time you call me, I'm going for vacation. I'm going to be 300-some-odd miles south in Utah, laid over. That, I don't want it to happen when I'm there.
Of course not, but at least you'll be able to make reports for us wherever you are. Cal, thanks. Yellowstone, really heating up. Here's an amazing story, and we've got a link for you at coasttocoastam.com. Take a look at that. In the spring of 2017, Gaia Filmmakers, that's right, that's our TV network for Beyond Belief, they joined researchers and scientists just outside of Nazca, Peru. Now, that is where Eric von Däniken got the incredible, compelling idea to write his book, Chariot of the Gods. Well, they went there to investigate an unearthed mummified body. Independent scientists and universities are currently analyzing findings, with initial examination suggesting the possibility of material unlike anything found in the fossil world. What the heck could it be? Now, we've got a link to the YouTube, to the Gaia YouTube channel, and already close to 3 million plus people on Facebook and YouTube have seen this incredible video. Now, the senior director of content for Gaia is Jay Widener. And Jay, this is an incredible story. I've got to ask you about this. First of all, tell me about the discovery in Peru. What exactly is this creature? And when people see it on the video, they're going to know it doesn't look human.
No, it's definitely not human. I can't tell you what it is. We're doing tests right now. Gaia is doing a whole plethora of testing. 3 different countries are doing DNA testing. And it's a story that's going to continue to unfold, and I can come and make updates if you like as we get the knowledge. And I think it's really an important discovery, but at this moment it's still kind of murky, and I don't want to go out on a limb and say what it is until we're sure. But I think you, as you said, it certainly does not look human.
It does not look human. Ironically, of course, it's found in the area where Eric von Däniken wrote his historic book, Chariots of the Gods, where his theory is that extraterrestrials came down here, did whatever they did on the planet, and this creature, when people see it on the video with the link that we've got to the Gaia YouTube channel, they will see a creature with 3 long fingers, and that is something that meets the description, Jay, of people who have seen these tall alien grays.
Well, that is absolutely true. I've, of course, been going through all of the literature in the last few weeks after, I witnessed this creature and found a lot of UFO alien stuff. I don't know if this is an alien. I don't think it is. But if it is, it is. We'll find out. But, yeah, you're right. There is a lot of 3-fingered alien
strange stuff
recordings all over the place, including from Area 51. So we'll have to wait and see how this is going to turn out. Keep watching both your show and Gaia, because it's going to be, I think, an amazing story as it unfolds.
When you first saw this being, this creature, and it's obviously it's petrified, and it seems to be capsulized in some kind of white look. But explain what that was. What is that white, pasty look all around it?
Well, we're doing tests on it, but from what I've been able to find out, the ancient people that did the mummification would put some kind of powder drying agent onto the skin so that it wouldn't dry out. Now, of course, I mean, it wouldn't get putrefied in the wetness. Now, of course, the desert where all these things are, Nazca Desert, is one of the driest places on Earth, a half an inch a year. So water is not a big problem, which is one of the reasons why we have these mummies, is because they're put in places that are so dry that the years don't make them, you know, emaciate and die and crumble to the ground. So in some ways, it's fortunate that they're in the driest place on Earth, because that way they stay intact.
And Jay, when do we expect some more results, testing and DNA results? When might
think,
we get that?
You know, soon, but DNA is hard because you have to recombine the strands after a long time of decomposition. The strands tend to break apart, and so it's like putting together a huge jigsaw puzzle. But we're committed to it. Gaia is committed to it. We're committed to finding out what this thing is, and full disclosure, that's what we want.
Well, we'll get it from you. Thanks, Jay. Appreciate it. Folks, go to the website, coasttocoastam.com. There's a direct link to the Gaia YouTube channel. You got to look at the video. It's about 6 minutes long, well worth looking at. Or you can go to Gaia, G-A-I-A.com, for some more information as well. Up next, we're going to be talking through the eyes of a physicist about the universe on Coast to Coast AM. Okay, welcome back to Coast, George Norrie with you, Professor Lawrence Krauss with us, internationally known theoretical physicist, wide research interests, including interfacing between elementary particle physics and cosmology, where his studies include the early universe, the nature of dark matter, general relativity, neutrino astrophysics. Now, he has investigated questions ranging from the nature of exploding stars to issues of the origin of all mass in the universe. And hopefully can give us some answers to these perplexing questions. Lawrence Krauss on Coast to Coast. Hello, Professor. Good to have you back on Coast.
It's nice to be back. It's been a while.
Oh, my gosh, it sure has. And since then, so many things have happened. They're finding exoplanets. They're doing all kinds of things. CERN is up and running. What do you think of that out there?
CERN, it's an amazing. It's the most complicated machine humans have ever built. It's amazing. You can't give it enough hyperbole. Every second at CERN, when it's running, there's more information generated than in all the world's libraries and all the books in all the world's libraries. It's really remarkable. And this 26-kilometer long tunnel underground in Geneva has to be evacuated with a vacuum that's sparser than the vacuum outside the International Space Station.
They were concerned, Lawrence, for a while that had they turned it on, it would have created black holes which could have gobbled up the planet and everything in it.
Yeah, some people were worried about that, not the scientists involved, but there were some people who were worried about it. And it was never a likely possibility. With various exotic generalizations of general relativity, there's the possibility of microscopic black holes being created. But even if they were, they'd disappear before they'd even leave the machine. So it was never much of a worry.
I always used to talk science with my mother. She's one of a kind. She's 88 years old now, just had a birthday. And, you know, we would talk about all kinds of things. And I'm beginning to think that whenever she talked to me about God, she was also talking about the universe. Because it seems like when I would say, for example, how did God get here? How did he start? She said, Georgie, he always was and always will be. And that's what I hear, Lawrence, about the universe. And I still don't get it. I still don't understand it. Maybe you can help us a little bit here. But I think she was talking about the same thing.
Well, except maybe. Generally, the difference is that when we talk about the universe, we base our conclusions on evidence and make predictions that you can test, whereas God generally is kind of an excuse for not thinking about the problem.
Yeah.
But the universe, in fact, our universe, had a beginning about 13.8 billion years ago. And it will, however, once again, we cannot say with certainty, but based on the evidence we can see, it looks like the universe will go on expanding forever. So while it had a finite beginning for 13.8 billion years ago, it will go on expanding forever. So that some people don't like the fact that it had a beginning and will go on forever, but that's the way it seems to be. The universe doesn't really care what we like and we don't like. And the amazing thing, as I showed in my last book, is that that you, without any supernatural shenanigans, it's possible to imagine a whole universe with 100 billion galaxies, each containing 100 billion stars, can arise from absolutely nothing, just given the laws of physics.
Now, that opens up, when you say it had a beginning, that opens up the question and the possibilities of, okay, if it had a beginning, what was before it?
Well, exactly. And of course, it's a good question, and a lot of people worry about it. One answer won't make you very happy, but I'll tell you anyway. It is that if space and time are tied together in general relativity, and therefore, if the universe pops into being, if space pops into being, then time does too. So that it literally, there may be no time before the beginning, the Big Bang. It may just not be a good question. Time itself may have arisen out of the Big Bang. Now, of course, that's one possibility. The other is that our universe, our Big Bang, was one of many Big Bangs, and there's kind of a global time, and there were Big Bangs happening in other universes before ours, and ones that are happening now somewhere else in a vast, infinite space. That's another possibility. But it is possible that time itself, you can't ask the question, what happened before, because it doesn't make sense.
We're with Professor Lawrence Krauss. His latest book is called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far, Why Are We Here? And that's a great question. Why are we here? You know, when I look around at people during the busy lunchtime here in Los Angeles or whenever I'm in New York or St. Louis, you know, you see people with their briefcases in their cars walking around on the Metrolink. And I just look at it for a moment, Lawrence, and I say, what's it all about? Why are we here?
That's one of the reasons why I wanted to write this book, because the discoveries of the last 40 years in particle physics have revealed to us that we're here more or less because of a cosmic accident, that the universe isn't designed for us. That the real answer to why are we here is that there's no reason. It was just a remarkable accident, just like ice crystals forming on a window with beautiful patterns pointing in different directions. There's nothing significant about each direction. If you lived on one of those ice crystals, it would seem like one direction was special, and maybe there was some divine purpose behind it. But that's just an accident. In our case, some field froze in the early history of the universe. We call it Higgs field. And had it frozen in a different way, we wouldn't be here. And it's just, it is just literally an accident with no special significance. And that bothers some people. But the bottom line is, don't be bothered by it, because we have evolved the brain and a consciousness, and it's remarkable that we're here, even if it wasn't planned, or even if the fundamental scales, the universe wouldn't, if it weren't for that field, we wouldn't even be allowed to be here by the laws of physics. We should enjoy our brief moment in the sun. Let's make the most of the fact that we have this cosmic accident, and then that you and I can have this conversation.
There are some who believe that this universe is holographic, digital, not really the real thing. It was somewhat created. That's kind of a bizarre thing, but what about those possibilities?
Well, there's different versions of this. A holographic universe, in some sense, comes from ideas from string theory, which say that, in principle, you can embed all the information in a higher dimensional universe in a smaller number of dimensions. So it's like a hologram. If you've ever looked through a hologram, it's a two-dimensional plate, but when you look through it, you see all the information of a three-dimensional world. So the question is, could the number of dimensions we see really be an illusion? And it's an interesting idea, but there's no evidence behind it. But I think what you're really referring to is the idea of something a little more like The Matrix, like the movie The Matrix.
Yeah, exactly.
And that, some people have argued that may be the case. I would argue that there's no real evidence for it at all. In fact, all the evidence from physics suggests otherwise. For example, you know, if you have a computer game, or if you have pixels on a screen, there are usually some dead pixels, something that just isn't working. When you look around the universe, you don't see any dead pixels. So there's no evidence of planning or purpose to the way we exist. And finally, as a physicist, I would say, look, if we are in an illusion, if we're in a matrix that is so good that it's indistinguishable from reality, my job as a physicist is to ask, what are the laws that govern the rules that determine how we're here? And the broader question is really not relevant, because if the universe obeys certain rules, the job of a physicist is to figure out what those rules are.
Stay with us. We're going to take a quick break, and we will be back with Lawrence Krauss. His new book is called The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. He's got lots of books out there, and we'll take your calls next hour with him. He's with us for an hour and a half left on Coast to Coast AM. We will be back in a moment with Lawrence Krauss as we talk about his work, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Why are we here? Just a great, I love talking to physicists, but he just makes things so easy to listen to. And we'll be back with him. We'll take calls with him next hour. Saturday, July 29th in Everett, Washington, we're going to have a live stage show. This is Coast to Coast. It becomes live in front of a studio audience, which is huge right now. And there are now, I can officially say, Thomas Danheiser, producer, only a few tickets left.
Only my mom calls me Thomas. It's more than a studio, George. This is amazing. We're headed up to see the production guys this weekend. It's going to be a fantastic show.
It really is. But tickets are going very quickly now. So my one concern is, what do you do if all the tickets are sold and somebody wants to come? They're out of luck.
Then they got to find me and see if I'm in a good mood.
All right, first come, first serve. This is how you get tickets. Go to coasttocoastam.com, click the fourth highlight button there on the home screen, or call this number, 425-258-6766, 425-258-6766, or Google Historic Everett Theater. And welcome back. You're listening worldwide to Coast AM. Lawrence Krauss is with us. His book, The Greatest Story Ever Told So Far. Lawrence, there seems to be so much order in the universe. I mean, it's like everything has a reason and it all works. Doesn't that imply that there's intelligent design out there somewhere?
No, well, that's a natural tendency people have. We want to look for reasons for things. But
right.
Even as Darwin showed us a long time ago, you know, order, design is in the eye of the beholder. You have to be very careful. You can look at these beautiful Christmas ornaments and say, well, clearly they're designed, but then what they really are electron micrographs of snowflakes, just water molecules. If you have water, it's a polar molecule, and the laws of chemistry and physics produce these incredibly beautiful patterns. Or you can say, talk about geodesic domes and say, look, Buckminster Fuller was brilliant. Clearly only humans could develop those kind of things. But then, in fact, if you take soot, just soot, and you look at it, we find these molecules called carbon-60, Buckminster Fullerene, that form geodesic domes. So, The appearance of design does not imply design. And just as Darwin showed that, you know, bees aren't designed to see the colors of flowers, it's just if they couldn't, then they wouldn't reproduce and we wouldn't be around. What we see as a universe that appears to be designed for us is not designed for us. In fact, more likely, it's not only is it not fine-tuned for us, we're fine-tuned for the universe. Namely, we evolved in a universe that allowed us to evolve. The fine-tuning is sort of the same as saying, isn't it amazing that my legs might go all the way down exactly to touch the ground?
Okay, here's one of my reasons for this incredible design. As strange as this is going to sound to you, but on this planet, we obviously need water to survive. Grass needs it, trees need it, plants need it, we need it. Who would design something called rain to bring water to things that need it or they would die? And that simple thing I look at and I go, God, there's some incredible intelligence here.
Well, you know, but think about it this way. We're life forms that evolved to need water in an environment in which there was rain. If there wasn't, you know, if we lived on Titan where there may be, you know, liquid methane,
mm-hmm.
Then we might find ourselves, although it's highly unlikely there's such life forms there, finding ourselves needing liquid methane. It's not too surprising that in a water-governed planet that life evolved that required water. And moreover, that rain forming is just, I mean, it's natural. It's no more surprising than the condensation on your mirror when you take a shower. It's just the natural properties of water. And the nice thing about this, by the way, is that water is ubiquitous in the universe. It's all over the place. And the things that life arose on Earth about as early as the laws of nature would have allowed, about 500 million years after the Earth formed, which is when the bombardment of asteroids and other things died down. What we need, if we're any example of whether life can arise, you just take water, organic materials, and sunlight, and life appeared to arise relatively quickly. And what's fascinating is all of those things exist in the universe. water. We can also see the basis of amino acids and comets and out in the interstellar space, and clearly sunlight. So it bodes well for the likelihood that, that life exists elsewhere in the universe. But you know what? If there wasn't water, how can we say that other life forms that don't need water might not evolve? We don't know the locus of all possible things that life might take the form of. And so I think you're turning things on the head. You say, isn't it amazing that because we need water and rain exists, that it looks like it's designed for us? But I think you have to say, no, we evolved an environment in which it rained regularly, and life was able to exploit that fact to continue to reproduce successfully.
Are you in awe at what's going on this planet?
Me too.
I'm in awe. I think knowing, you know, that's the thing from my point of view. You don't have to invent all sorts of fairy tales or myths. The universe is absolutely amazing as it is. In fact, it's more amazing than anything the human imagination can come up with. The imagination of nature far exceeds that of humanity, which is why we have to keep looking. Every time we open a new window on the universe, we're surprised. And I'm in awe every time I look at a Hubble Space Telescope picture of the amazing things that happen in the universe. You know, we just discovered gravitational waves from black holes colliding 3 billion light years away. It's taken all of humanity's history before we could develop an instrument that could do that. But the amazing thing is the universe is so big and so vast and so old that if you work it out, somewhere every few minutes, black holes are colliding. Every second, somewhere in the universe, a star is exploding. It's almost unfathomable. The universe is so amazing.
Now, are you saying that our presence here is a fluke or luck?
Yep. And it's, you know, and the point is there are 100 billion stars in our galaxy, each containing many, many planets probably, so there are 100 billion solar systems. And it's not too surprising that we find ourselves living on a planet that allows us to live. It would be kind of amazing if it weren't the case. It would be quite an interesting radio show to talk about it if we couldn't live on this planet.
Go ahead.
You know, if there's so many different possibilities, finding ourselves on one of them has no special significance except for the fact that it allowed life to rise. And it seems so special, but if there are many possibilities, wherever you are, you're going to feel special. You know, the physicist Richard Feynman used to point out that the easiest person to fool is yourself, and everything that happens to us seems to have significance. You can have a million crazy dreams over thousands of nights, and then one night, you'll dream that your friend breaks their arm, and the next day they break their leg. You say, oh, wow, clairvoyance. But it's just you don't remember all of the crazy dreams. So he used to go up to people and say, you won't believe what happened to me today. You won't believe what happened. And people say, what? He'd say, absolutely nothing.
At the age of 15, I had an argument with my science teacher, Mr. Strom, where we would talk about planets. And I would tell him, I would say, Mr. Strom, you know, there's more than just the 9 planets in our solar system. They're everywhere. They're all over the place because I believe that the complexity of the universe, the primordial soup, is the same. And he would argue with me, Lawrence. He would say that's not the case. We haven't found any more planets. It's just ours in our solar system. But sure enough, this kid, me, with no scientific knowledge, no major telescopes, nothing to find out other planets, I was right. And he was
wrong. You were right. And it's nice to know that in science there are no authorities. There are experts. But there's no authorities whose words are beyond question. And everyone, the lowliest high school student, can question the words, not just of a high school teacher, but of a Nobel Prize-winning physicist. And the point is that nature is the arbiter of what's right and wrong. We aren't. And what we like or wish was the case is irrelevant. And you were right. It turns out that Giordano Bruno was burned at the stake for also arguing that there might be an infinite number of planets. The Catholic Church didn't like that. Happily, you existed in a time when you weren't.
Yeah, absolutely. I wonder if I would have changed my story.
Yeah.
Where does time fit into some of this? I mean, and is time travel conceivable in this universe?
Well, time is elusive for many people because although general relativity and special relativity tie together space and time, clearly, there's a difference because I can go on a round trip to Boston and back from the West Coast, but I can't, at least as far as we know, do a round trip in time. And time seems, you know, so much more elusive because it has a direction. The future is different than the past. Now, in general relativity, because space and time are tied together, you can imagine, and because the nature of space and time are determined by the energy that fills space, so space curves and expands and contracts in the presence of the right kind of energy, you can write down mathematically a kind of energy which would produce a universe in which time travel was possible. And so according to the mathematics of general relativity, time travel isn't a priori impossible. But the big question is, so I can write down that kind of energy that I'd need to make a universe in which time travel is possible. The big question is, can I create that kind of energy? I can certainly write it down mathematically, but physically, can I create it in the laboratory? And the answer is, we don't know. We just don't know. Most of us are probably betting it's unlikely. My friend Stephen Hawking wrote the foreword for one of my books, The Physics of Star Trek, and it got in the front pages of the papers in England because he had previously said time travel was impossible, and then, of course, in my book, I talk about how it isn't impossible. And since Stephen Hawking changes his mind, you know, about time travel, he previously said time travel is impossible because if it was possible, we'd already be inundated by tourists from the future. However, I countered him by saying they all went back to the 1960s and no one noticed.
That's right. You may be right, too. What excites you the most about what you study?
Well, I think what excites me is the fact that I don't know what's coming up next. Is that the universe, every day I'm surprised if I'm not surprised. Every time we open a new window, as I say, we find vast new surprises about nature. And so for me, what's exciting is that even though I'm a theoretical physicist and I'm paid to sort of think about how the universe might be, the realization that the universe is stranger than I can imagine is what excites me. That and also that we can actually build machines and test these ideas. I didn't think when I was a young person that we'd ever be at the point of discovering gravitational waves. We now have seen them. I didn't think the Higgs would be discovered in my lifetime. I didn't think that we'd be able to actually potentially be able to measure processes back, evidence of what happened when the universe was a millionth of a billionth of a billionth of a billionth of a second old. But we're on the threshold of being able to do that too. What we can do with our technology, if we put our minds to it, is truly remarkable.
It really is. It truly is. And, you know, when we talked about so many planets that are out there and other planetary systems, what are the possibilities then? I won't even ask if you think we've been visited, but...
Oh, I think it's highly unlikely we've been visited. The laws of physics make that really, really highly, not only extremely difficult, but the point is we're nowhere special in our galaxy. We're in the remote edge in the corner, and there's no and the only evidence that there'd be intelligent life on Earth would have only gone out about 50 light years from now, because, you know, with our TV shows like Star Trek,
that's
and
right.
Else, and got it. So the likelihood that we've been visited, if you think about the rationale for it, is, and given the physics requirements of traveling through interstellar space, is extremely remote. But what's great about the fact that there may be lots of life in the universe is we don't know what the possibilities are. Are all life forms based on DNA like us? We don't know. Are there civilizations that are billions of years older? We don't know. It's, as I say, unfortunately, because the universe is a big place, even if life exists elsewhere in the universe, the likelihood of knowing about it will be remote. But we have various programs. I'm involved in a program related to something called Breakthrough Starship and then Breakthrough Listen, that we're listening for signals potentially of life elsewhere in the universe, intelligent life. The chances of discovering it are remote. It's a long shot. But surely, if we did, it would be one of the greatest discoveries humans have ever made, to know that we're not alone.
We've got some friends out at the SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence, where they have been, you know, trying and trying for the same thing to get...
And what's great about SETI is this new infusion of money from this Russian millionaire, Yuri Milner,
yes,
of more or less $100 million to try and improve the whole SETI program, has really, really given it a boost. And I think it's great because, frankly, it's such a long shot that I'm not sure I would recommend that government funding agencies fund it, but it's great that private money does, and I think it would be inspiring. It's a long shot, but it's worth continuing to do. And the level of funding required for it compared to many things is not large.
Do you believe in life after death? That once this physical body is gone, that it continues?
Well, let me say, first of all, I never use the word believe.
All right.
I don't think scientists should use the word belief. Things are either likely or unlikely. Whether we believe requires some act of faith that's not based on evidence, and that's just not the way it works in science.
We dreamers can believe, I guess.
Yeah, well, dreamers can hope. You can hope or expect. But anyway, it's just, maybe it's just semantics. But having said that, there's certainly no evidence of life after death, and everything I know about the universe makes me think it's highly, highly, highly unlikely. And that means, you know, again, that for some people that's a very depressing thought.
Sure.
I find it an enlivening thought, because it means the time we're here, the time I'm here on Earth is more precious. I should use every moment, because those are the only moments I have. And I should use my brain and enjoy and experience the universe in its full wonder. So I find it more precious. And I think if you have that attitude, then you know, the need for life after death is not so great. Plus, frankly, for me, the idea of immortality is horrendous, horrendous. Why would you want to be stuck with your in-laws for eternity?
Eh, some of them are okay, I guess.
Yeah, but no, you know, as Woody Allen said, the eternity, you know, the thing about eternity is near the end, it's a very long time. And there's a difference between infinite and very, very long. You can imagine, at least for me, I can't imagine anything I would enjoy doing it for an infinite amount of time.
So the universe is about 13 plus billion years old. Does that mean that 13 plus billion years in terms of time and space from now out is where it started, where they started, the other star systems?
That's a good question, because it represents a sort of a natural misconception about this. The Big Bang happened at every point in space. All of space started expanding. And so when we look out, of course, we look back in time. When we look out 10 billion light years away, we're looking back 10 billion years in time. But in those locations, the universe is the same age there as it is here. And so everywhere, the Big Bang happened at every point. And so there are stars forming here. Our galaxy formed 12 billion years ago. In other places, galaxies formed 12 billion years ago. So it's no different anywhere else. It's basically every point in the universe is more or less the same as every other point. And again, that was initially an assumption. But it's an assumption that we validated.
What do you think, Lawrence, jump-started all of this when it started?
Well,
was the catalyst?
It's amazing that as I've written in my last book, that the laws of quantum mechanics are such that there doesn't have to be a catalyst per se. For example, when the light bulb and the light in my study emits light, there's no cause for the electrons to jump from one energy level to another and emit the light. They do. I can't predict exactly when it's going to happen. And if space and time, which are the variables of general relativity, are become quantum mechanical, as we think must be the case, if there's a theory of quantum gravity, then in quantum mechanics, things are fluctuating all the time. And if space and time are quantum mechanical, then space and time is fluctuating. And you can suddenly pop, universes could suddenly pop into existence that didn't exist before, just like the light emitted by my light bulb suddenly pops into existence. There weren't photons inside the atoms, but they were spontaneously emitted. You can create space and times spontaneously, and most of them will disappear very quickly, but some of them can exist for a long time. And if you ask, what would be the properties of universe that was created from absolutely nothing by quantum fluctuations, and could live 14 billion years, those properties would be more or less exactly the properties of the universe we measure, leading me to suggest, at least, that it's highly plausible that our universe just popped into existence spontaneously, given the laws of quantum.
And that's dramatic all by itself. Stay with us. Lawrence Krauss is with us. We're going to come back. Final hour to go, where we will take your phone calls as Coast to Coast AM.